It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 587 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, Mark A. Nelson and Jeff Ryan are interviewed during a great crowdfunding doubleheader. Mark A. Nelson is a comic industry veteran who has tackled work for just about every publisher in the industry. His book, Thunder Hunters, is now available for support on Zoop.gg and is described this way. Artist and adventurer J.D. Holbrook has traversed and recorded the natural history of an uncharted planet. Thunder Hunters is the unique, culminated cross-section of his sketches, journal entries, sequential stories, and portraits of inhabitants across the expansive Vermilion Sands region. We discuss the book and how Mark assembled it, who J.D. Holbrook actually is, then get into his other great offerings. Be sure to back this excellent project after you listen to this episode. Then everything wraps up with my interview with Jeff Ryan, who's crowdfunding books about the secret history of Marvel Comics Spider-Man and how Carrie Fisher made Princess Leia Star Wars' rebel hero. We particularly delve into Spider-Man and creators John Romita and John Romita Jr. Jeff describes the popular Marvel character as the hero who could be us. We explore fascinating behind-the-scenes info about the webslinger and his creators, including some engaging info about another Romita who actually saved Marvel. Don't miss these excellent books about popular comics and sci-fi characters on Kickstarter today. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what both creators have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Mark A. Nelson, a comic industry veteran who has held various professor and art director positions throughout his career and has tackled work for just about every publisher in the industry. He's probably best known for his work on Aliens and Godzilla and has had influential stints on Action Comics, Green Lantern, and more. So how you doing, Mark?
I am doing fantastic. How are you?
good to talk with you. The reason why we're talking today, of course, is you have a Zoop project that's going on right now. It's zoop.gg, and it's called Thunder Hunters. Do you want to talk about it? Do you want me to read a little bit off the website? What would you prefer?
I don't know. We just keep it casual. Let me talk about it, and I'll just...
Sure.
It's just sort of a... It's a comic book that I've done for a long time for myself with just the love in between other projects. And it's about an artist on a foreign planet who goes out into an unexplored area called Vermilion Sands. And he meets the locals, the animals, and he makes drawings of them. And he tells their myths and their stories in sequential, comic pages. There's about seven stories in the first issue, ranging by a whole bunch of different things. And there's pinups of royalty. There's pinups of a little bit of everything. And there's pinups of him as he wanders through the jungle, finding different kinds of interesting remains and animals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So he's kind of an explorer.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a little bit like if you know who James Audubon was in the early 1900s and, George Catlin, who actually came over from England and went through the West and made portraits of a lot of the Indians and the Indian tribes and brought those things back. So it's kind of, pre-photograph material, so it was all drawings and etchings and paintings. So with both those guys, that's what they did. So I thought it was kind of fun to do that same kind of thing on an alien planet.
That's cool. Do we know the name of the planet by any chance?
That's a secret.
Okay. All right. We won't worry about that then. Now, he's the only human on the planet, pretty much?
No. There's more. It's just a nice mix of, what do I want to say? You know, it's a typical science fiction, high fantasy, Jack Vancian type of story. You know, there's humans, there's alien creatures, there's alien species and cultures and all that kind of stuff. So it's just sort of wide open for a lot of, interpretation at this point right now.
Okay, pretty cool. And this, of course, is going to be the way I understand the way Zoop works is this is going to conclude no later than May the 11th. But I could be a little wrong on that. There might be some flex in that. But don't wait until then. Be sure to get out there and go to zoop.gg/C as in cat/thunderhunters, all one word. And that'll give you a chance to get in. Now, before we get too deep into this stuff, we have to say, you want to say something?
I was just going to say, when they go and look at the site, you know, the way Zoop handles it, handles it is that they've got the, you down, you see your rewards, but if you keep going down, they have a whole preview, a lot bigger images of the pages and some of the artwork that's in there. So you can really take a look at what you're going to get when you buy the book.
Which is really great. I mean, the artwork was really stunning, I have to say. Really beautiful to see.
Well, thank you.
Very great. Sometimes it's black and white, sort of, and sometimes it's full color. Yep. And I notice you're selling some of the artwork, too, is what's going on as we're speaking.
Well,
so,
what's happening with those are little drawings that I do. And since I've sort of become involved in this, let's call it this creative world of mine, all these little drawings are, again, like would be in a sketchbook of his that you'd find. A couple of them are in the book, but most of them are just me relaxing, having fun, thinking about different kinds of things. So they're unique. It will say in there in the book, or it'll say unique, one-of-a-kind drawing.
Very cool. Very cool. So you've got, as we said, you've got a long-term career in comics, but I did want to mention one thing that's very important to point out. I think this Zoop.gg actually funded in, 6 hours?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a great accomplishment. And as we're talking, you're heading towards 3 times what you originally asked for. So Congrats on that. That's wonderful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is. It's like anything else. You just kind of go, okay, let's see what's going to happen. You know, I mean, it's been a lot of fun. The Zoop guys have been great. They've been pushing it. I've been pushing it. And we're just trying to, you know, get the rest of the world as excited about it as we are.
Great, great. Because I saw there was a Zoop.gg interview that they did live with you, where they actually get to see you, which, of course, mine's an audio podcast, so we don't get to see that on my podcast. But if you want to see Mark talk with Jordan from Zoop, you can go on, I see it on YouTube, but you can go on, I think Facebook too has it on there too, so you get to do some stuff. So we'll try not to cover the exact same stuff, but there's a lot of really good stuff that I think people need to know. Now, this is a hardcover, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and how many pages in it, do you know?
At this point, it's 104.
Okay, so that's a good, nice side hardcover for that. And let's see, as we're talking, of course, by the time this posts, it's probably going to be a lot different. You can get a digital copy, or you can get the hardcover. Now, the hardcover, it looks like, as we're talking, 71 people have claimed hardcovers, and you can also get it signed by you, and that's 15 people have taken it so far.
Yeah, so, and then there's also one with a remark where you get a little drawing.
Yeah, so, do you get to request a remark, or is that something that you provide?
Well, I'm evil that way. You have to let me have some fun.
Okay.
Because otherwise, people are always going to go, well, you know, I was kind of thinking of, you know, as the Eiffel Tower collapses when Godzilla runs through the, you know, France, kicking the arch to triumph, you know, across the screen, and you're like going, no! So, you know.
Yeah, so it's easy for a writer to say there was a big explosion and hundreds of people died. But as an artist, you've got to somehow turn that into a graphic. And that doesn't take as, you know, because we just said that in a few seconds, you're going to spend a long time trying to make that into a visual.
Yeah.
So it's, people have to be really careful when they ask for graphics and stuff like that from people. Think about what you're asking the person to do is the thing I like to ask. So let's see, you got that. See, I'm kind of interested because this is a mix of stories and the images and things like that. So does the story go continuously from beginning to end? Go and like break up the story somehow? How does that go?
Well, with me and with this, one of the things that, and I'll be truthful about this, that I think when people look at other illustrators, art, or artists and things like that, they want to pigeonhole you into an oil painter, acrylic painter, this, that. And I said, if I'm going to do this book and I'm going to do it for myself, some of the stories are going to be black and white. And I work with tone paper and black and white pencil, which is a real traditional sort of chiaroscuro method. Some of them I work just with straight pen and ink and a lot of crosshatch. So that's traditional. And most of the rest are done traditionally as far as a pencil line and then, you know, inked and then I color in Photoshop now. So those are the more of the sort of traditional comic stuff. And a lot of the illustrations are the same way of the creatures. Some are black and white, some are color. You know, there's just a range of them. And a lot of it was, for me, the mood I was in and the mood that I wanted to create for the story. So One story is called Fishing, and that's all black and white. And it's a little story about the author, J.V. Holbrook. And I just said, I don't want to color this. It works as a black and white. And that's the kind of thing that I like to play with a little bit, you know what I mean? Because everybody says, well, if you do a comic, it has to be this, period.
Right.
And I don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you got to do the things that you like to do, right?
Yeah, that's exactly how I kind of approached it. And I think it's funny because when a lot of people have seen some of the black and white stories that I've shown them to, they really like them. So I think it also shows that as an artist, you can have quite a few diverse skills to produce your images.
Right, right. So that really shows in the book. But I can see the images on that Zoop.gg page. You get to see some of the graphics and some of the illustrations, which are really, really sharp, I do have to say. Really beautiful, really great. Now, I understand that you're something of a Monster fan.
No. How could you get that?
I understand, because I was listening to you talk to somebody else about the fact that you like some of the monster books. I mean, Marvel used to do the monster comics. In those days, you know, Fin Fang Foom and all those good things. And I obviously from the graphics that you're doing in there, there's a lot of that kind of influence on that. So I got to ask, how do you come up with the monsters? Do you sit down and start to draw them and the inspiration hits? Do you know what they're going to look like before you start to draw? How do you do that?
Well, I think you sort of, it's one of those nails you can hit in a lot of different ways. The one thing that I did a book for Dover called World Building. And, it's all about thinking about what you want to do when you want to create a world. And some of the early Thunder Hunter drawings are in that book, too. But that's a book that kind of talks about how I think and what I go through and everything else. Now, when I was younger, I almost became a vet because I just love animals and nature so much. Mm. And that's led me in a year long. Sorry. It's led me in a lifelong sort of love of animals and forms and shapes. And nature is always form follows function. So that's a lot of stuff that when I sit down and I start thinking, okay, I'm going to do an aquatic creature or I'm going to do this kind of a creature or that, I start thinking about, well, you know, look at all the variations you have in fish and the way they eat and the way their gills move and the types of fins they have. So, you know, sometimes you say, okay, can I make this fish look a little bit more elegant by giving him longer fins and creating a long, thin body and, you know, more of a elegant, sharp face? Or do I want to make it a bulldog face? Do I want to do this? Do I want to do that? How horrifying do I want it? My problem with most people when they design monsters is they do the thing where they give them all those long, sharp, pointy teeth. And there's nothing in nature that has long, sharp, pointy teeth. The moray eel has an incredible set of teeth, but the teeth are slightly curved, and they go back because when he would bite you, or she would bite, you know, into a scuba diver, you would try to pull away, and the teeth, because they're curved back, set even deeper in the flesh. Mm-hmm. So if you're a scuba diver, you're supposed to relax so that your muscles aren't tight. And if the eel lets go to get a better hold on you, that's when you pull, you know, your arm out. So a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff for me is research, reading about nature. I read, you know, science books. I'll admit probably 50% of it is like way over my head. But I know how many fins, you know, a fish has and what they're used for. I know what, you know, certain things that they do. And I always try to create believability in my characters, you know. And I think that's where some people go wrong with their creatures and some of that. They just go, wouldn't it be cool? And that just turns me off, because when somebody says, design a monster that's cool, what does that mean? You know, because your definition of cool, my definition of cool, are two for different things. But if someone says, we're set in a mountain landscape, and I want you to design a terrifying creature that can climb up rock faces and do da-da-da-da and da-da-da-da, you know, that is something that you go, okay, now I've got some skeletons to hang the meat and let's flesh this out.
Yeah, because the more realistic they are, the more scary they seem to be to me. Because if you want to have, because I'm looking at some of the illustrations, you've got like, it almost looks like a kind of a mix between an ape and a lion and a dog of some sort. There's a red-haired woman and there's these beasts running in front of her. And that's a really, because that to me is some of the scariest, because that's very likely we could run into something like that. So I like that. I thought that was really daring.
Well, that creature you're talking about with the women, she's got the red hair, right? Is that the one you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. That creature, there's a story in the book, and this is, it's about, when you read about the cultures and the tribes and their myths, there's always stories about how the various gods create, you know, whatever, the trees, the trees, insects, animals, and things like that. And that creature that you're seeing in that story is in another story where it shows how it came to be and how the gods created it.
Okay, so that's kind of cool. So, well, I've got to ask a question. I'm always curious when I read these things. J.V. Holbrook, is that you? Are you J.V. Holbrook? Is this a creation of your imagination? Where did he come from?
J.V. Holbrook is actually one of my favorite science fiction writers. It's sort of a nod. It's a tip of the hat to him. He's somebody, when I started reading him, changed my whole outlook on science fiction and writing. And he really, you know, was a brilliant writer, I think. And he wrote science fiction and he wrote mysteries, you know, and did a lot of very, I just want to say, great cultural stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really loved his work. So, and I kind of hate to give away who it is. But
Okay. Well,
I'm sorry.
Maybe we'll try to figure that out as we go through the book. And by the end of the book, we'll have a better idea as to just exactly who he is. But well, is his visual patterned after somebody that is the same guy? Is the way that he acts and the way he looks are based on this character, this person?
No, because the person himself, well, he was a merchant marine. He traveled around the world. He did a lot of different kinds of interesting things in his life. So I never got a chance to meet him. I corresponded once with him with a letter. And, he was just a very sincere gentleman from what I heard. And at the very end of his life, he was going blind. So he, you know, could barely do much as far as signing or writing, but he, you know, could blow the images up on his computer so big so he could sort of read what he had written.
Wow.
But, let's put it this way. It's okay. It was Jack Vance.
Oh, okay.
And his name is actually John Holbrook Vance.
Oh, okay.
Hey, and nice. he wrote in the science fiction under Jack Vance, and John Holbrook Vance is the mystery writer. So
cool.
I've let the cat out of the bag.
Uh-oh. Well, I think people appreciate knowing that. I think it's kind of cool. Very, very
well. Then you need to know the other part. Vermilion Sands comes from another one of my favorite writers.
Okay.
And that is a book that when I was teaching illustration, I actually brought it in and gave the students two or three stories to read, and they would have to do an illustration based on that book, Vermilion Sands. And that's J.G. Ballard.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And another writer who really, really, really got my interest going was Keith Roberts. And he wrote a book called Pavan, in which the Spanish Armada makes it across the English Channel and takes over England instead of the storm destroying them. And then the whole world is changed and the church rules the world. So that's a very interesting collection of short stories. And one of them, is on lithography. And that's what I taught, was printmaking and lithography. And I would bring it in and make my students read it, because it's so on the money and it's so beautifully written about him working on these lithostones and doing things. He knew his stuff. He just knew what a print shop was. He knew how it worked. So all these guys have really affected me. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. There's plenty more.
I'm sure. It's kind of interesting because these days, you know, the computers, as you were mentioning, have kind of taken over a lot of this stuff. Even like print, printing presses and stuff now have computers in them instead of being, you know, I used to know a guy who used to know how to do a manual printing press, and he would not learn how to do the computers. And he ended up, you know, kind of out of work because everybody switched over to computers, and he just didn't want to learn the computer stuff. So,
It's the digital press. You know, digital press is something that is a little bit different. But actually, the interesting thing about digital press is that you can really control the ink flow and make just little areas change and glow so beautifully. I went over and was watching them print a friend's print on a digital press, and he said, "Can you make this more yellow?" And he typed something in, and all of a sudden the next couple of prints started to get yellow, and he got exactly what he wanted. So the digital press is pretty interesting. The difference is that you don't have the same kind of plates, and you also get a sort of a much shinier ink to the paper. So, you know, there's parts of this. Some of the digital presses that I think look great, and I think there's some of them that just kind of look like it's a plastic image pasted onto a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. Whereas the old comic books, you know, were done all on plates, and they're printed on that really cheap, awful newsprint, which sucked the color up. And there's just no, it's just so gorgeous when you look at when I look at the original comics, and then you turn around and you look at the Masterworks collections, and they print them on that white paper, and all of a sudden you're seeing 100% yellow, which just burns your retinas out, and it just looks terrible, because those people counted on the newsprint, to suck in that color. And if you look at the colors, you know, for 256 colors, what the colorist did back then was pretty darned incredible.
Really amazing. Really quite astounding stuff. Now, which, of course, talking about computers, are you doing things by hand, or are you using the computers to draw stuff?
Both.
Okay.
And the one thing that I would say there is that I'm still faster on a piece of paper and a pencil because I've worked in the video game industry as a concept artist, and I can just pencil a lot faster and get things done quickly because I've been doing it so long that way. When I draw on the computer, I can't get the same scope and the feel of the size of the page because I'll be sitting there drawing away on stuff and then I'll blow it up to 8.5 by 11 and it's like I've just rendered, you know, something that's the size of a fly's toenail. And I've just spent 2 hours on it. So I still prefer paper. Mm-hmm. Most of my original art is either pencil or the pen and ink and the comics, and then all my coloring is done in the computer.
Interesting, because you know, I know some artists who do everything on the computer. And one of the bad things about doing that is like you're selling original art. You can't really do that with computer artwork because if you print it out, it's nothing original to it. It's just you can make 60,000 of them, and the people don't really care to get printouts as much as they want the original art that you developed. So you're smart to do the original art, I think, and then you can always, if the time comes, you need a little bit of money, you can always sell some of the art and make a little money. You can always recreate it if you have to.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that what I tell people is that I'm also an old printmaker. And with what I did is I went out and bought a very high-end printer, which prints with, archival inks, and I use archival paper. So if you buy a print from me of one of those images, I only print so many. And that's it. You know, they're archival. They're rated for about 125 years. Hmm. So that's the only way the color version of that exists. Mm-hmm. So I try to explain to people all that stuff before I do it. A lot of people that are doing sometimes that the print stuff, what they do is they'll do a full color drawing and then they take it over and get it photocopied. And, you know, I think people should be aware that there's a difference between a photocopy and what a good print is, but that's just me.
Well, I agree with you. I think that that's an important thing to know. You know, you and I, of course, understand the print process. I used to work in public relations, and I used to go and see these things come off the press. And it's amazing how when something comes off the press, how it looks different from what you're looking at on the screen. I had a publication that had red headlines, and the body text was brown. And when it came out on this light brown paper, it was like the red jumped off the page and the brown faded into it and you could hardly read it. I said, nope, you got to make the text black. We can't have it go brown because mm-hmm. you won't be able to read it. So it's a lot of people don't understand that. They just see the finished product and they don't realize that you've got to do those kind of checkings ahead of time. But you as a teacher, of course, you probably have taught people a lot of those things.
Well, another thing about that very simply is your computer is RGB. And most presses are CMYK. Mm-hmm. So that a lot of times when I'm coloring in Photoshop, I make sure that all my colors don't go out of gamma, you know, so that my colors will be printable in CMYK. So when I send it to a press, the other thing that people don't take into account is you're looking on the computer at light. So it's shining light into your face and everything looks brighter, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you go to print, everything gets that 10% value gain. So that means a 90% brown becomes 100% brown, or 90% black becomes 100% black. Mm-hmm. So you have that 10% gain. So I always back off my colors when I get stuff ready for proofing and printing. Mm-hmm. Because, again, it's a different thing on the computer versus on the paper. And my printer that I have has got 3 values of black, 2 values of yellow, 2 values of magenta, 2 values of cyan, and 3 values of black. So cool. I get even more out of my colors because I know I took some stuff in to show some of the people that I was having print a little book of mine, and I showed them what my printer does here, and they just went, you know, holy Moses, look at those colors. Wow. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just real quick, so people, RGB, by the way, is red, green, blue. And CMYK is cyan, magenta, yellow, black. And that K at the end is black. And some people don't understand that about that, but that's important, I think, for people to know as far as those
things. Yeah.
Now, one other thing I heard you talk about with some other folks is that you've got this whole book is completely done, and you're actually almost done with a whole nother book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, wow, you've been working ahead. That's nice when people do that, because sometimes when I back like a Kickstarter, it's years before I finally get the stuff that I bought. But I love it when I hear people actually have the project pretty much complete or actually complete by the time a crowdfunding happens. I got to say that is I wish more people did that.
Well, the thing is I know I can understand financially why people kind of want to get paid so they can make a living. And this book for me has been something that I've worked on my own pace. I worked on it in between other jobs, and I just sort of amassed enough work. And my wife finally said, do something with it. It's starting to make the house settle funny. And all my friends that had done crowdfunding and different things said, if you have it all done, you're so far ahead, and that's great, because some people, like you just said, hate to wait, for this thing. And a lot of people have not, in 5 years finished the project. Well, I'm done with that. I could be going on the next one, finishing that off. And so, yeah, I took the advice of some close and dear friends, and hopefully, having that much done and everything will be helpful.
Boy, I hope other people listening to this take this to heart, because there have been many Kickstarters I've backed that I've never seen any of the stuff I backed. So always a good thing to do that. Now, Chris, I got to ask, I know it's a little early in the game, but is the second book similar to the first book? Is this
it's got different stories, more stories, and then there's a couple longer ones. And then there's a lot more pinups and animals and fun stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So is it at the same place? Is the main character, has he gone somewhere else, or is it still in the same world?
It's still in the same world.
Okay, great.
It's all sort of Vermilion Sands. It's like anything. If when you think of, I'll put it simply this way. When you think of when they first landed in Australia, all the people lived along the coast and nobody went into because they didn't know what was there. So that's kind of what it is. So if you think about the planet, think about most of the livelihood, because in the very first couple pages, there's a letter from the Goodwin Williamson Museum, and they're talking about how this guy staggered in and showed him all this work. And that's what this book is a collection of his work that the museum has put together. So if you're a comic book fan, you know who Archie Goodwin is. And you know who Al Williamson is. So that's my huge nod to those two gentlemen that just did fantastic work their whole lives.
Very cool. So the second book is actually going to be going inland, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, basically, no, it would be like, let's just say that Holbrook showed up and he's got a portfolio of 800 images. Well, you can only print so much at a time, so... That's their choice. They printed out this set, and then they'll be going through and doing the next set and that. And then, eventually we can say maybe he'll run out of images, or there might be a longer story where it's just like, okay, here's a story of him going into Vermilion Sands once things start to change again. So it's, there's still a little, what do I want to say? Everybody wants to know this complete backstory of all this stuff. And I kind of like a little mystery, If I tell you everything, there's no fun. And how do I want to say it? It's just.
You want the mystery. I like the mystery. Keep the mystery around. That's a good thing to do. Now, of course, because I haven't seen the book, I'm just kind of curious. Does the length of the stories vary?
Yes.
Okay, so you basically tell the story and you don't worry how long the length the story is.
No.
Oh, small. Oh, I love that.
They're all self-contained. It's just like when you're sitting down with somebody and they decide to tell you a story about their cat or their dog. Sometimes they just go, "Yeah, it was really funny today. The the cat jumped on the dog, the jump jumped on a burrow, and they ran across the street and ate Farmer Willis's, you know, garden. Mm-hmm. The end, you know. But then on the other time, you can make that a much longer story, or you can build each one of their unique personalities into why they did this or did that. Mm-hmm. Just like with Grimm's Fairy Tales and Hans Christian Andersen and all those people, the stories range in length and description and different kinds of quality.
Yeah, I think that's so much better. So many times, well, I'm going to use a comic-related thing. There was a, like when I think it was on Netflix, I think they had the Marvel stuff, and they always had 13 episodes. Mm-hmm. And you could always tell about 7 episodes in, they said, oops, we're running out of story, and they would have these longer pauses of sorts. And then they would get back to the original story, and it would, you know, pick up speed towards the end. And I'd always be kind of like, I think I could have skipped those episodes 8, 9, and 10 because it had zero to do with the story. But so this is why I always like to ask people, tell the story. Don't worry about how long it is. If you tell it well and it's a good story, we'll love it. We won't sit there worrying how many pages it is. So I think that's great.
Well, a lot of that too is, like, I know when I was working at Marvel, they wanted to do everything in a 6-issue arc, you know. Mm-hmm. That way it's 6 issues, it gets done, it can then be collected as a trade paperback and sold, and they make more profit that way.
Yeah, my brother. Again,
that's a business attitude. Same thing with, like, when I first started drawing comics, you know, they were roughly about 28 pages, and now they're down to 22, you know,
right,
for ads and other things. So, yeah, it does change the business model, the different things, depending on who's editing and who's doing what. But, you know, in a lot of cases, I remember, gosh, you know, you pick up a comic book and you get 2 stories per issue, you know.
Right. Oh, I read an old 1940s Batman book, and there were 4 stories in the average-sized comic. It was about 30 pages or 40 pages, mm-hmm. and there were 4 stories in there. And I was just sitting there going, like, wow. Because, you know, now you're lucky if you get 1 story in 6 issues. But they had 4 of those in one. I just sat there, you know, with my mouth open. It was great. I just loved that.
Well, the other thing, too, is I've always been a big fan of this sort of, you know, when you think about the pre-superhero era with the Mossmans, and even the early Ant-Man stories in, you know, Tales of, oh, gosh, I'm going to get it wrong. Oh, I can't do that. Anyway, the early Ant-Man stories, mm-hmm. you know, they were short stories in a collection of other, you know, stories.
Right.
And then he got his own comic, you know. Was it Tales to Astonish? No.
I think it was. I think.
Yeah, okay.
I think it was, but we could be wrong.
But anyway, if we're wrong, then the comic police can come and handcuff us and take us. But, I mean, you know, Fing Fang Foom was a longer story. But it was still, you know, one of at least 3 in that issue of Strange Tales.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I like that, you know. And then it's like, I remember when the first 2-issue Fantastic Four came out, and you were like, oh, my goodness gracious, gobbledygooks, you know. I got to get 2 issues, you know, and you could barely wait for a month. Now, I've read comics that in 1 issue, they're doing what used to take like 2 or 3 pages in an older comic, and they're just lengthening this stuff out.
Yeah,
it's like, ugh.
Well, there was an Ultimate Fantastic Four where the entire issue was them going from one side of the Baxter Building to the vehicle and leaving the building. And that's it all took place in 1 issue. They just them walking through the hallways and jumping in the Fantastic car and taking off. And that was the whole issue. And I was like, they used to do this in like a couple panels. I was just sitting there going, man, I spent too much money on this book.
So I didn't like that. And, you know, I was talking with someone, it was Graham, and we're talking about, you know, Paste Pot Pete. And, you know, there he is, the villain, and he carries this pot of paste with a gun that shoots it, and he's wearing a purple beret, and he's got a little sort of Fu Manchu mustache, and he's got this heavy outfit, you know. And then later on, you know, they slicked him up into sort of an Iron Man like thing, and that's the whole thing too, is like his science and everything gets more elaborate because you look at what even just films know, what we can do in Iron Man and all the special effects. I mean, to see Jack Kirby's world of a giant floating head in Guardians of the Galaxy is just incredible to me. But it was even more incredible, and I hate to say this, in the 60s when it came out, because there was nothing like that. So, you know, we were lucky, or I consider myself lucky, because not only do I get did I get to experience it as an artist and a child, but I got to experience it now, you know, with the great movies. But then it's a lot of what you're saying. Just because we have all these special effects, do we have to use them? Because no matter how you look at Kirby, it was always the story that was so important to him.
Yep. Jack Kirby is still the pinnacle to me. I mean, I love other artists. There are many others that are artists that are wonderful. But Kirby used to make these incredible devices. There was this multi-dimensional shooting device that, and it had all these tubes all intertwining with each other. And I'd look at it and I'd go, wow, that could do that. You know, just the way he drew it always made me a believer. And so I sort of miss those things now, because, you know, that was the fun of comics, was to see those amazing things and to buy them.
Well, I think the other thing, too, if you really think about it, you know, when you watch an old 50s science fiction movie, I always joke about it. I sort of say to people, you know, it's like these guys build a rocket ship and they go, we're going to the moon. And they're saying, well, how do you get back? He says, we'll figure it out when we get there, you know, kind of thing. There was a big suspension of disbelief. Now, you know, I mean, when Kirby was drawing pistols, sometimes they were just boxes. Now you've got people that are, you know, the writers, and I don't blame them, because they're, you know, the writers are, you know, the important part of the whole story process, obviously. But, you know, the amount of range of weapons that we now have, and information and research and things accessible to us, you know, when they're talking, okay, you got to use a Glock. And most people go, huh? You know, there's a difference between a Glock and a 45. There's a difference between, you know, all these rifles and all these guns and everything else. When you look at a lot of those early ones, you know, most people didn't have the accessibility to all this imagery and understand so much stuff that we have today. And then you have, like, I think to me with, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and even some of the other Marvel board games or different things like that, where they start to list how strong the characters are and what they're capable of doing and who's the strongest or who's the weakest, who's the tallest. So we have all these lists of everything before we even sometimes get into the character. And that was always the fun thing to me, was like, you know, that was the joke at Marvel. You know, if the Thing and the Hulk have a fight, who's going to win? And, you know, so you kind of had fun because sometimes the Hulk did, sometimes the Thing did. You know, nowadays everybody is, you know, well, my character wouldn't do that kind of thing. And there's no more of that kind of naive playfulness.
That's I'm hoping your book will help bring back some of that, because it looks like it's a lot of fun. And it's very real, you know, because in the sense that we get to experience things and discover things as we go along. And I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be something great to be able to enjoy that again. So again, it's if you go to zoop.gg/seasoncat/thunderhunters, all one word, you get to support it. And it's going to conclude right around the 11th of May. So I wouldn't wait to be in the last minute. Be sure to get in there now so that Mark can, he doesn't have to sit there and go, oh, no, nobody's supported it in the last 15 minutes when he refreshes the screen. Which everybody who does crowdfunding sits there and does that, I swear. And we want to get that, so you're so far ahead that you don't even have to worry about such things. I think that would be great for you, Mark.
No, it would be a lot of fun, too. I think it's a – I mean, I've done so many different things, and I have to admit, you know, I mean, I can't complain. I've had a wonderful career with the stuff I've done. I've done a few projects that have been like pulling teeth, but, you know, overall, I've had a really great time in the comic book industry, and, you know, to be able to finally sort of pull out all the stops and kind of do what I wanted to do has been a lot of fun. So I, you know, how can I complain? I can't, you know.
No, I'm sure the book will be fun to read. So are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
Well, I got to. This is another strange thing. I did a whole series of fish drawings that I put up on Facebook, and everybody really enjoyed those. So I'm trying to get a fish book put together of all my fish drawings. So again, you know, it's that whole kind of love of nature and love of different kinds of fish and their forms and their shapes. And it's got a very nice little intro written by Ian McKeag and one by Tony Dirtalizzi and another one by Randy Broker, who is a wonderful fantasy artist. So three people whose work I've always loved, and they really kind of enjoyed the book. So that's sort of dangling out there, and hopefully that'll get put together.
Okay. Are you on social media? Because I'm just wondering, how do people keep up with the projects you're working on?
Well, okay, social media. I am on Facebook as two things. One is Mark A. Nelson. The other one is Grazing Dinosaur Press. And on Instagram, I'm Grazing Dinosaur Press. And if you go to YouTube and you type in Grazing Dinosaur Press, I have about five videos up on drawing and the way I draw, the way I think, and all sorts of different things like that. So they're kind of fun. You know, a lot of people go, well, they're so long. I said, what do you mean long? Well, they're like 15 minutes, you know, and I'm like,
oh my gosh,
wow, you know. My attention span is a lot longer than that. So there's some fun stuff there. I talk. One of the videos is just drawing different types of hair on a face. Oh, wow. And that was a lot of fun for me to do. Mm-hmm. So they kind of, I cover a lot of basic stuff. I cover different things. And a lot of people have expressed that they really enjoy that. The other thing is that I'll bring it up one more time. If they go to Amazon and they type in Mark Nelson and they type in World Fantasy, they'll get my book. And that is 125 pages, and there's at least 3 to 4 illustrations on each page. So it is a very thick book full of just the whole thought process of thinking and building stuff. And it's not a step-by-step book. It's like a book that you read, and I show you how I solve some of the problems and different ways you can solve the problems. But it really is up to you as the creator to finish, you know, your own world building. And a couple old students have come back to me and said, boy, as I was reading this book, I felt like I was back in the classroom with you. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of fun.
Very cool. Well, it's all great stuff, Mark. I hope people take advantage of these good things. Again, it's Thunder Hunters, and it's on zoop.gg. And you want to be sure to get in there before the project ends in early May. Don't wait. Now is the time to get there and back it and support Mark so we can get Thunder Hunters 2 in the future. That'd be fun to see. So keep up the wonderful stuff, Mark.
Thank you. I'm trying to. And like I said, always scroll down because you really get to see a lot more of the art. And if you want to read the testimonials, I have some pretty nice people that have said some very nice things about me. So I'm very excited about the book.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread?
It's great to welcome to the podcast Jeff Ryan, the number one bestseller from Super Mario and A Mouse Divided. He has a pair of narrative nonfiction books currently Kickstartering. And for once, we're going to talk about the comics. And there are some comic illustrations in the book that you sent me to take a look at, Jeff. So we're going to talk do about that. It's you've got books, one called Father and Son Issues, The Secret History of Spider-Man.
That's right.
And the other one is Your Worshipfulness, which people will recognize, the dual biography of Carrie Fisher and Princess Leia from Star Wars and stuff. But since most people, I know literally thousands of Star Wars podcasts, we'll probably stick to Spider-Man more. So
I think you've made a pretty good case over the last almost 600 episodes of saying you're a pretty big comics fan. So
I've been doing this for 10 years, believe it or not, and a long, long time. I was just thinking it might be 11 now, but I don't keep track of those things. But anyway, we'll probably stick to Father and Son Issues. It's a triple biography, it's called, of longtime Spider-Man artist John Romita, John Romita Jr., and Spider-Man. Everyone from Monica Rambeau and Shuri and Hit Girl to Wolverine, the Punisher, and Kingpin are Romita co-creations. You'll also learn everything you wanted to know about Spider-Man, even stuff like Sins Past and One More Day You're Trying to Forget. So what attracted you to Spider-Man? I mean, besides the fact that he's like the number one seller for Marvel.
Well, he is my favorite superhero, and I always wanted to write something about comics. And at first I thought, well, it's got to be Superman. If you're going to write about a comic book character, you pick the one that everyone knows, the guy with the superpowers, the guy who started it all. But then like 8 Superman books came out. So like, well, I mean, I'd love to write about Spider-Man, but I can't write about Spider-Man. I'm an adult. I can't do that. And then I met a friend named Buddy at a party, and Buddy is a longtime comics fan and worked for Wizard Comics and all that. And so I posed a question to him. I said, who is like the Zelig figure of comics, or the Forrest Gump? And Forrest Gump, not for his intellect, but for the ability to always be there at all of the important moments that were happening. And Buddy thought about it for a moment. Then he said, oh, John Romita Sr. So I was like, oh, I never thought about Romita Sr. And I looked into him and realized he's so associated with Spider-Man as a character. And then his son, John Romita Jr., who is my favorite comic book artist of all time, is also associated with Spider-Man. I was like, okay, so this is becoming a no-brainer. I'm writing about the Romita clan and the relationship with Spider-Man. So I get to write my Spider-Man book after all.
Oh boy, because I'm a Batman guy. My favorite artist happens to be George Perez, who died recently. And I just count myself fortunate that I actually got to see his stuff coming out when it did. So Spider-Man, now see, this is a thing, and you talk a little bit in the stuff that I read about Spider-Man and what it is about him that makes him so popular. And I'm just curious, well, why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's important to know.
Okay. Spider-Man, as everyone who is listening to this probably knows, has a full face mask. He could be anyone under there. He could be you. He could be me. And when you're reading it, if you're a young kid, it's really easy to imagine that you are Spider-Man, a lot easier than imagining than you are Captain America. Like, am I 260 pounds of muscle? No, I'm not. I could be that Spider-Man guy, though. I could definitely be Spider-Man. And they've grabbed onto that with the whole Spider-Verse idea. There are so many different Spider-Men and Spider-Women and Spider-Girls and Spider-Boys. No matter who you are, what your shape, there is a Spider-Man who looks like you, who is you out there.
Mm-hmm. I was intrigued one part I read where they talked about they were trying to figure out what it was that made Spider-Man popular. And it wasn't the spider. They thought people were scared of spiders, but it was the man. It was the thing that he did as a human.
Exactly.
And I thought that was a really insightful thing, because one of the things about Marvel Comics that stands out to me is that most of the characters, of course, you've got Thor and gods and other things like that, but most of the characters like everyday people. I mean, Sue Storm had a bad hair day, and Spider-Man gets a cold and he gets defeated while he's got a cold. And stuff like that doesn't happen to DC characters. They don't do that over any other comic company. So that's Spider-Man to me is the quintessential Marvel character.
Yeah.
Did you get that sense too?
Absolutely. I've never read a Batman comic where Batman ends up saving the day and then needs to ride back home on the bus. That happens to Spider-Man pretty regularly. Whereas like this, oh, this is what a revolting development this is.
I talked to, I think it was Mark Waid who wrote a story, because if Spider-Man's not in the city, he has real trouble getting around because he can't swing from building to building. If he's out in the suburbs, and it was Mark Waid or somebody else wrote a story.
Peter David wrote one in the 80s.
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah. He had to get on a bus. He had to ride on the top of the bus, and the editor turned it down because Spider-Man wouldn't do that. And then what did the editor do? He wrote a story where Spider-Man is on the top of the bus and the writer was very unhappy about that. But the emphasis on the man, of course, Peter Parker, he doesn't win very often, let's say.
No.
He'll beat the bad guys, but he won't. Well, for a while, they actually kind of turned him into Bruce Wayne, which bothered me. He was the head of an international conglomerate. He was doing all kinds of stuff. And I was like, that's not Peter Parker. That's Bruce Wayne.
That's Tony Stark, because he even had Spider-Man as his bodyguard. And that was his excuse for why Spider-Man kept showing up.
Yeah, Iron Man, anybody? That's definitely that. So they decided, I guess, after a while that Peter Parker should stop hiding from the landlord and not paying the rent on time and stuff like that. So suddenly he's married to the most gorgeous model in the country, and he is running a big company and stuff like that. And I think that was after John Romita's days, if my spider sense is not tingling.
Right. What you're talking about, the Spider-Man Worldwide arc, was, I think, 2015. That was right after Secret Wars. So that was right in the middle of the dance slot run.
Mm-hmm. And talk about Romita, because John Romita came in at a very interesting time. Spider-Man, Stan Lee, of course, had come up with a lot of the characters, and Steve Ditko was the original artist. And I remember a lot of people saying that nobody but Steve Ditko could ever draw Spider-Man. And then in comes John Romita, and poor Mr. Ditko, I think he took a backseat to Mr. Romita as far as being the ultimate Spider-Man artist.
Right. Stan and Steve each had very different ideas of what they wanted Spider-Man to be, and neither one of them truly is Spider-Man, because they were pulling from one direction and the other, so the Spider-Man comic that resulted for 38 issues was somewhere in between. Stan more or less wanted Peter Parker out of the picture, and he just wanted Spider-Man all the time. And to Steve Ditko's credit, he insisted on having as much Peter Parker as Spider-Man. Now, what Steve Ditko wanted was a Peter Parker who kept on growing and evolving and made fewer and fewer mistakes and ascended higher and higher into society, into the world. The idea that he would be running his own company is very much a Steve Ditko idea, because that's the hero who keeps conquering on higher and higher levels of achievement. But that's not the Spider-Man that we ended up getting. So when Steve Ditko ends up quitting, and Stan Lee needs a replacement, he brings in John Romita, who he had kind of poached from DC. In reality, DC had let John go because their sales were down in their romance department, where he had been for 8 years. So John Romita, with his 8 years of romance experience, comes in and is told to start telling Spider-Man stories. So he comes up with stories that are basically his freelance adventures, except mapped onto Spider-Man. So instead of trying to always get a drawing assignment, he's always trying to get an assignment from J. Jonah Jameson to take pictures for the Daily Bugle. And instead of trying to woo a girlfriend in John's real life, he's trying to not let down his wife and his young kids. So there's always something that's got to give, whether his professional life, his personal life, his home life, his family. And that's what we think of as a Spider-Man story, that he's just continually plate spinning. He's always going to help others and let himself down and let his family down. And they don't know why he does it.
Interesting. I never knew that before, that John Romita's Spider-Man had a lot to do with him shadowing himself. That's really interesting to me.
Right. And you can go so far as to say that Mary Jane, who wasn't a real character before he brought her in, Mary Jane was John's wife, Virginia Romita. just the same way that Stan Lee had always intended for Gwen Stacy to be his wife.
Interesting. See, the behind the scenes stuff, you know, I always say this with people with television stuff. If we understood what was going on behind the scenes in the TV, things would make more sense, because things that happen behind the camera often influence what we see in front of it.
Exactly.
And it sounds like the same thing with comic books, interestingly enough. So that, I'm finding it interesting, because I remember a lot of people said that when John Romita came on, he drew people too beautifully.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. He drew people like a toothpaste commercials, he called it one time, or Sunday advertising supplements. Mm-hmm. Everyone looked so polished and clean. He said like his New York City was the only place in the world where there were no scuff marks. There wasn't any tire treads. Everything looked brand new and freshly poured from the cement mixer.
Wow. Well, see, that's interesting to me. And yet that he's the one that people remember now more than anybody as the Spider-Man artist, which was so radically different from Steve Ditko. And I find that so interesting that when people go away you don't expect, suddenly that takes off and right. goes along.
So and it helped that John Romita started to work in Marvel's licensing department in the 70s and as Marvel's art director. So he came up with the house style for Marvel's art and what other artists should draw like, and he can't help but draw like himself. So other people started to draw Spider-Man the John Romita way. So even if you see a Spider-Man on an old distressed t-shirt that isn't truly a John Romita original, it still kind of looks like a John Romita. So that right. became people's idea of Spider-Man. The Spidey living in your head is probably John Romita Spider-Man, even if you've never read a John Romita Spider-Man issue.
You know, when I was a kid, I remember I got a poster, and I think it was a John Romita Spider-Man, and it had a white background, and it was like 6 feet tall. And it was on the wall, and I every once in a while the in the morning the light would hit it in just such a way, and I'd look up and I'd see the white eyes, and it would scare me.
I was always scared of Iron Man growing up, because I would see Iron Man and Doctor Doom, and I couldn't really tell, like, that's the same face. Bad guy in one, good guy in the other. I don't buy it. I think they're both bad guys.
So how long did John Romita draw Spider-Man?
He drew Spider-Man on and off for 15 years. He did the better part of a decade doing Amazing Spider-Man. And sometimes he was penciling. Sometimes he was doing rough layouts. Sometimes he was inking other people. Sometimes he would just do the covers. And then he went from there to doing the daily Amazing Spider-Man newspaper strip, which is still running, but he did every strip of the first 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And did he have any influence on the introduction of Gwen Stacy?
He had an introduction on the exit of Gwen Stacy. His idea to kill off Gwen Stacy. The Spider-Man editors wanted to kill someone off, and they assumed, well, Aunt May, she's like 108 years old. It's the old bag's time. But John is like, no. If you get rid of Aunt May, Peter's life gets easier, because he doesn't need to lie to someone. He doesn't need to always cover up and always worry about Aunt May in the hospital. He's going to be sad, but he's going to move on, and his life is going to mature, and he's going to move on to the next stage of life. If you kill Gwen Stacy instead, Spidey's going to be so sad. We're going to get years worth of stories out of it, and we can get all of the poor old Aunt May needs her medicine stories.
Because she's still alive, if I remember correctly.
She is still alive. Yes, she died in 1994, and then miraculously came back in 1998. And we don't talk about that.
So I always find those kind of things interesting. So what else did John Romita introduce during his time on Spider-Man? Were there other things that specifically stood out?
There's a number of supervillains, like the Hammerhead, like the Shocker, most notably Kingpin. And because he grew up in Williamsburg during the Great Depression, his sort of Spider-Man villains weren't mad scientist type. They were mobsters. They were gang lords and crime bosses. So that's what you think of with a Spider-Man villain now. Someone who isn't trying to take over the world, but is trying to rob a bank or strong arm some people out of money.
Okay. That's interesting, because that Spider-Man was known for, like, the Vulture and Dr. Octopus and people like that. And there was a whole – I don't remember seeing Dr. Octopus very much during the Romita years.
No, they would they did something akin to what they do nowadays, where a villain will show up for two or three episodes and then they'll take a few years off, because it's always a big deal when they come back. With you have someone like John Romita, who has a steady tenure on a book, he may draw it for 5 years and you never see the Lizard. But then when you do, wow, you get to finally see what John Romita's Lizard is going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Very different, very, very unique for him. That was kind of a stretch for me. I read in one of the paragraphs you had written about the fact that the reason he went back to Marvel was because he wanted to draw superheroes.
Exactly, yes. He had a job working for an ad agency, and he was going to start that on Monday. And I think the Friday before he started, he went to go see Stan Lee, who he used to work with and get jobs from about 10 years before. And he really just wanted to draw superheroes. He'd been drawing for DC for 8 years, and he never got to draw a superhero. The closest he came was someone pitched him the idea of ghosting Wonder Woman's faces, because John Romita was great at drawing beautiful women, so he could draw not Wonder Woman's body, but just her face. Not any of the layouts, just faces, 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 and he turned that down. If he wanted to draw someone, he wanted to actually draw them, not just a portion of them.
That's funny. It reminds me very much of like Bruce Timm on Batman the Animated Series. His whole group was really good at drawing male figures, but when they drew female figures, they looked like kind of like skinny men. And so what he did was they brought in a woman artist who taught them how to draw the female figure, which was really interesting to me. And I got a huge kick out of hearing that, because I do like his superheroes are very big and certain, but it's interesting that that he didn't get to do that with Wonder Woman. That would have made a big change as far as Wonder Woman goes.
Yeah, the female form is the original ultimate thing to draw, and it's one of the reasons why is that there's a wide variety of different shapes and sizes to draw, and it's hard to get it right. It's very easy to get it wrong and draw something that does not look like a woman.
Yeah. That is, I can think of examples, but we won't go into that right now. Let's talk a little bit about why he ended up leaving Spider-Man. Was he tired of drawing Spider-Man after so long? Did other opportunities present themselves to him? Why did he stop drawing Spider-Man?
He more or less got kicked upstairs. He became the art director because he was one of the few artists who, instead of working freelance from their home, wanted to work in the office. He wanted to be part of the Marvel bullpen. The Marvel bullpen, by the way, was something Stan invented, and he was not hanging out with all of these people all day long. He pretended he was, but he was very lonely. He was an extrovert who was alone in the office all day long, so he finally had a buddy at work, and he kept on leaning on John to make all of the art changes he wanted to see for all of the other Marvel comics, so much so that that became John's full-time job. And then John had other people working under him. Eventually, they got a nickname, Romita's Raiders, and some of the best comic artists working today got their start in the early 80s as Romita's Raiders.
Now, didn't he draw Fantastic Four for a while?
He drew Fantastic Four for 4 issues. So oh, wow. This is, if you talk about the Parker luck, here's the Romita luck. He has to step in for Amazing Spider-Man after Steve Ditko leaves. Mm-hmm. And then after Jack Kirby draws like 102 issues of Fantastic Four, guess who they come in to take the big punches for? Oh, I can't believe you let Jack Kirby go. And now this second-rate guy comes in. They had John Romita come in for 4 issues just to get people used to the fact that Kirby wasn't on the book, and then John Buscema took over.
Okay, yeah, wow, that was a big change too, because he was a big artist as well.
Right. So when you say John Buscema, you probably think Conan. The last thing you think of is a Fantastic Four, but he did that for a year or two.
He did Avengers too, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Yeah, so, but Romita, I don't think ever drew Avengers. Did he do other Marvel books? Obviously, you said he's kind of dictating or directing the style. Might be a better thing. Dictating sounds a little heavy-handed. But what kind of an influence did he have as an art director over like the Marvel line?
He did covers. At times, he did dozens of covers per month. So it became a bit of a bait and switch, because you see this great action-filled cover with the... John was very insistent that he didn't just draw beauty shots or random fights. The core conflict needed to be represented in the struggle that was on the cover. So you would then open up the issue, and the cover would accurately represent the story of the comic, but it would not accurately represent the art that was inside the comic. So you'd see an A cover, you'd open it up, and you'd see some B or C or D material, and you'd feel disappointed. You saw the bait and then the switch once you had paid your 12 cents and gotten the insides.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but that wasn't the only time I've been bait and switched by comics.
No, it's rare that you see a comic whose exterior actually is representative now. So yeah. If you see an X-Men comic and the White Queen's on the cover, she may not even be in the issue. She may not even play an important part. It's just, yeah, we had this art, so we threw it on there.
Right. So how long was he the art director for Marvel?
He was the art director of Marvel on and off for the better part of 20 years.
Wow. Wow, and he retired at some point?
He retired in the mid-90s. Marvel was going through a pretty bad bankruptcy. So he realized that he needed to leave before he was going to be let go, because everyone around him, everyone above him, everyone below him was being let go. And he was one of the people who had to let people go. And that was really wounding for him, because he had been like guiding people's talents and inculcating their careers, some people for decades. And all of a sudden he's the one given the axe and said, you've got to let all of these people go and come back next week for the list of the next people you've got to let go.
Oh boy. Yeah. I can imagine that's pretty tough for somebody, particularly who sounds like he got attached to his fellow creators.
Yeah. And the irony about the guy who swings the axe is that at a certain point when he's done, someone says, I'll take that axe. And then they axe him.
Yeah, that's true. Oh man. Did he draw much after that? Or did he, has he pretty much stayed in retirement?
He'll draw on and off. Virginia, his wife, and there are chapters of my book all about her. And she's my favorite character in this. Not Spider-Man, not John Sr., not John Jr. Not that anyone aren't great, but I was so surprised with Virginia's role going from wife and mother to what she becomes for Marvel, which is fascinating. I don't want to spoil too much for you if people don't already know, if they're not in on it.
I'm not in on it. I had never heard of this. This is something I got to look into. This sounds interesting. I've never heard of that. So I'm going to have to, if you don't mind, you gave me a little copy to read. I'm going to try to go back and read that, because I have no idea what that's all about.
Yeah. Virginia is a, let's just say that there's one Romita who ended up saving Marvel from bankruptcy, and it is not John Sr. and it's not John Jr. It's Virginia.
Wow. That's interesting. I'm fascinated. Of course, that's a good segue. Let's go into John Jr. I did get to interview him on a podcast once. He was at the New York Comic Con, and I interviewed him. I did mention his father to him, and I said, and everybody, of course, talking about how great he is. And I said, you know, your father was pretty great too, I said. And he started to laugh, because he doesn't hear that too very much these days. But I went to tell him, I said, man, your dad, he is something. And of course, how did John Jr. get to draw Spider-Man? How did he get in Marvel?
He got in Marvel through the back door. John Sr. loved working with comics, loved working at Marvel, but knew that it was a terrible grind. And like all fathers, he wanted something better for his son. And there's... supposedly, the way to really hook people into a story is to make two things happen to their characters. This is for fiction, for someone like Spider-Man. One thing is to make their greatest dreams come true, and the other thing is to have their greatest nightmare come true. So John Romita's greatest dream was to draw superheroes and do it well and have people love it. That all came true. His greatest nightmare began to come true when his son started to get interested in what he was drawing the days that he was drawing at home, and started to draw also, and kept throwing his drawings away because they're not as good as John Romita originals, which... you know, of course, you're 9 years old. You're going to draw as good as Jazzy John Romita. But JR never gave up, kept trying to get better, and said, you know what, Pops, I want to join comics. I want to do what you do. And John put his foot down and said, no, absolutely not. You're going to college. If you want to be an artist, fine. Go work as an art director for an advertising agency. That way you can work 9 to 5 and get paid twice as much as you would working 70 hours a week in comics. You'll be more respected. You'll get a 401k. You'll get a pension and benefits and health insurance. You don't want to be in comics, son. You don't. But JRJR was undeterred. He kept on fighting to get in, and he eventually got a job as a grunt working in the black and white department of Marvel.
Well, before we get too much farther, we should mention the Kickstarter information. If you go to Kickstarter and look for Your Worshipfulness and Father and Son Issues, you'll find these books there, and this project will be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, May 13 at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And you have a $10,000 goal, and you're well on your way to get that. And I hope people get to jump in and be sure to get this. Don't wait until Saturday the 13th. Be sure to get on there and back it right away, because there's lots of really interesting and unknown information that are in these books, and I think that people would really enjoy them. So don't wait to do that.
Thank you for that plug, Wayne. You did better than I could.
Let's get back to JRJR. Okay, so he starts to turn in stuff at Marvel. What is it that gets him recognized?
The very first thing he does is a bit of a white elephant, a bit of a curse. He gets a backup in a Spider-Man annual. And so he's not just a guy named John Romita Jr. He's a guy named John Romita Jr. drawing Spider-Man in, like, you know, the premier book. An annual, but still, Amazing Spider-Man is Marvel's prestige book. And right. He does 6 or 7 pages, and Al Milgrom finishes it off, and Al Milgrom makes it look good, but he feels very disappointed by the material. And he feels like everyone around the office is saying, oh, this is Junior. This is just Junior, the untalented son, and his dad pulled strings to get this second-rate art published, and he got Al Milgrom to finish it so that that it looks professional. And to this day, JR feels like he's being haunted by those words, that he always needs to prove that he's good enough, that he's not just riding on his dad's coattails. Even though, like you said, a huge number of comics readers weren't alive when John Sr. was drawing. They don't know who he is. And if they see the art, they think, oh, that's kind of old fashioned. That's like what my dad's comics look like.
Okay, so what happened after that experience? How did he start to go up the ladder or start to get better recognized?
He did a few pieces here and there for Marvel's UK line. He started to work with Bob Layden on a run of Iron Man, which ended up becoming the definitive run of Iron Man, which is Demon in a Bottle, where Tony is shown to have an alcohol problem. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that even though John Jr.'s drafting abilities were not yet firm, his storytelling ability, which he picked up from the old man watching him draw Daredevil and then Amazing Spider-Man for decades, was first rate. He was able to communicate a story graphically in a way that few other people were able to. And that's still a skill that he has.
Mm-hmm. So when did he draw Spider-Man? Did he do it on a regular basis?
He did it starting in the early 80s. So he was drawing during the Hobgoblin appearance, the mystery of who was the Hobgoblin. And that mystery went on for the better part of 15 years because the mm-hmm. Spider-Man writers forgot that they didn't tell the ending of the story of who Hobgoblin was.
Okay, because and that obviously is what launched him. And he's been doing a lot of stuff since then. You know, the old, I see JRJR, everybody pays attention these days. So he has definitely risen his status from that early experience.
Yes, his art is incredibly distinctive and evocative. You're never going to think John Romita Jr.'s art is anyone else's. Like, I could see someone who's a good Jim Lee clone drawing a Batman, and you think, is that a Jim Lee Batman, or is that someone else is just drawing like him? There is no one who draws like JRJR. His work is distinctive and sui generis.
Do you know what he's up to these days?
He is drawing Amazing Spider-Man and putting Peter Parker through some hellacious bad luck.
Okay, so wow. So as far as we can tell, he's probably going to be doing that for a while, I take it.
Yeah, I think they're going to keep him on Amazing Spider-Man for a while. He was at DC for about 8 or 9 years, which was a huge move because there hadn't been a Romita at DC since 1964 or so. But after 7 or 8 years at DC, he decided to come back to Marvel. And it was during COVID, so it was everyone was heading back home and hunkering down.
Okay, very good. He's going to be, I imagine he'll be there for a while because Spider-Man is the primo number one character in Marvel. And some people would argue he's the biggest comic book character currently, or has been for a while.
Right. And one of the reasons JR decided to maybe leave was there were so many characters he hadn't drawn. Imagine being a man who's been drawing comic books for 30 years straight and never drawing Superman. It just seems crazy that, like, the one character that people know and you haven't drawn him because you work for Marvel. And he had drawn like 6 month to year long runs almost every character you could think of at Marvel, even some you don't even remember anymore. But he hadn't drawn any of the A-list characters from DC. So he got to go do that and draw Batman for a long time and Superman. And he made up his own characters there. But in the time that he was away, Marvel had a whole lot of new characters. Ms. Marvel is there, the Miles Morales Spider-Man. He's got a whole new crop of toys to play with, new characters he hasn't drawn to keep it fresh for himself.
Does he draw Miles Morales? I haven't seen that.
He did a big spread with lots of Marvel characters, and Miles was there. But he doesn't have a Miles book right now. Okay, but I'm hoping that he does, because I think that would be a great fit.
That'd be interesting to see because Miles, you know, he's the one that's the main character in those animated movies, not Peter Parker anymore. So right. That's an interesting thing to do. So that's good. As far as Spider-Man goes, what would you like to see? You know, because you've studied obviously the character and his comings and goings over the years. Is there something you would like to see Spider-Man do moving forward?
Oh, are you asking like a fan question? Like, what would I want to see if I got to write Spider-Man myself, or what do I just want to read other people do with Spider-Man?
How about both?
Ooh. The superpower I always love most about Spider-Man is the spider sense, the ability to sense danger. And in my head, my headcanon is that the reason why Spider-Man, who has 4 comics a month, is so much busier than any of the other Marvel characters is that he uses that spider sense like a homing beacon. He's swinging around and he subconsciously starts moving towards the bank that's being robbed. That's why he happens upon it and someone like Captain America doesn't. Because Captain America is only in one comic a month, so he doesn't have time to find all of these bank robberies, but Spider-Man does. So I'd love to see something where he's aware of this talent that he has, and he is able to track danger throughout the city and maybe get some other heroes involved in it.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. I haven't seen that done before. That'd be fun, because I was kind of surprised when he joined the Avengers. I didn't see him as an Avengers kind of guy, so...
No, and then he joined the Fantastic Four, and then he joined another Avengers team, and then he started to teach the X-Men all at the same time. He had a very busy few years there.
He's also teamed up with Wolverine when Wolverine was more popular and stuff, so he gets around that guy.
Yep, that's why he needed so many clones in the 90s.
See, I liked Ben Reilly, and they keep mucking him up, and this drives me crazy about that. I actually talked to J.M. DeMatteis about that, and I said, you know, you should be writing Ben Reilly because you actually treat him right. They keep making him into crazy villains and stuff like that, which I don't like happening. But that's just me.
No. I think they treat Ben like a what if character, like all the stuff we can't have Peter Parker do, we'll let Ben do. If we want Peter Parker to become evil, but we're not allowed to, we'll have Ben become evil. If we want him to die, but we can't, we'll have Ben die. If we want to have him come back, but we can, we'll have Ben come back. So Ben gets all of the storylines that Peter is not allowed to have.
Okay. So again, it's Father and Son Issues, The Secret History of Spider-Man. Now, before I let you go, though, let's talk a little bit about your worshipfulness, about Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia and Star Wars and stuff. When you wrote the book, of course, Did you start writing this when she was still with us, or was it after she passed?
No, it was a couple of years after she passed, and I was writing it the year that Rise of Skywalker came out, and I wanted to conclude it with a chapter about the making of Rise of Skywalker, because I felt they needed to end the Leia story this way. The story begins, my first chapter is how they cast Princess Leia, because they looked for thousands of different teenage girls, and they couldn't find the right Princess Leia until they finally got Carrie Fisher. So even though Carrie dies by near the end of the book, the Leia story continues, and they're able to continue the Carrie story by using footage of her in Rise of Skywalker. So right. that's the final chapter.
Do you think they'd ever recast that role, or do you think that they'll just let the character kind of go to the background?
Technically, they did recast her in the Obi-Wan TV show. She was supposed to be a six-year-old, and so they got a six-year-old girl to play her. That's probably not the recasting that you mean. You probably mean, like, you know, somewhere during the original trilogy era, Carrie Fisher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. That I'm not sure if they'll do. They did it for Luke Skywalker. For Han Solo, they recast the character instead of deepfake the face. And I'm not sure if they would feel comfortable doing either with Princess Leia. I think that she'll stay off screen and maybe people will talk about her, but we won't actually see her.
Were the things that you learned about Carrie Fisher and Princess Leia that stood out to you when you put the book together?
Yes, I knew that she was a script doctor. She started to work on the Steven Spielberg movie Hook and didn't get credit for it. She was paid, but she didn't. Her name isn't up on the screen when you watch Hook. And that started a very long career for her. For about 10 years, she was a script doctor. She would be on set making sure all of the characters said the right things, that their motivations and their dialogue made sense. If anything could be improved, she would come up with multiple suggestions for that. So that's why you didn't see her very much in the 90s. She was on set, just not in front of the camera.
Interesting. So it's interesting. What about her family and stuff like that? Do we see any of the her relatives on screen these days?
Her mom, Debbie Reynolds, passed the day after she did, which was part of the tragedy of her passing.
I remember that. That was really odd.
Yeah, and she has a sister, Jolie Fisher, who's now working in the unions, and the union, the WGA, is on strike, so she is probably very busy right now, again, behind the scenes, not in front of the camera.
I bet. So what do you think about did your opinion of Princess Leia change after you wrote the book? Did it start one way and you found out some things that changed your opinion about her?
No, it did change a lot. Yeah. I never disliked the character, but, I started to look at her as a character throughout the whole trilogy, the original trilogy of movies, and she's the only consistent character throughout it. Han Solo starts off as like a rogue, and then he decides to join the rebellion, and then basically nothing happens in the third movie other than he gets thawed out and is the same person he was at the end of Empire Strikes Back. Luke is great, but then in the third movie he makes his heel turn and becomes like seemingly a bad guy for no reason other than to then have a baby face turn at the end of the movie and become a good guy again. Leia is Leia throughout. So that constancy is something that I appreciate. She's always tough, always determined, and never gives up.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's called Your Worshipfulness and Father and Son Issues, two books. Books about how Carrie Fisher made Princess Leia Star Wars rebel hero and about the secret history of Marvel Comics Spider-Man. It's going to be funded if it reaches its goal by Saturday, May 13, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Don't wait until that time. Be sure to get out there and support it right now. And Jeff, you're doing wonderful stuff. It's really interesting to find out these things behind the scenes. I always think that those are really good things to know. So I think you've done really good stuff. Are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
The Kickstarter is taking up most of my time. Not many people have kicked off two different books at the same time. Only Brandon Sanderson, as far as I know, and he did four books. He got $42 million. So I'd be content with $21 million. I'd be content with that.
Yeah, I take one of those millions. I don't need all of them. Just give me one. I'll be happy. So are you on social media in case people want to follow what you're up to?
I have a newsletter. If you go to jeffryan.substack.com, you can join up. I have a different villain quiz every week where I ask 11 questions about a different villain every week. We alternate between Spider-Man villains and Star Wars villains. But last week, I went into the musical Broadway canon and I did Salieri, the bad guy from Amadeus.
Oh, wow. Okay. I don't know zero about that. I wouldn't know anything about that one. So I'm more of a comics guy, as you can tell.
You could take the Sandman or Vulture quiz. You do very well with those.
Probably. Better anyway than that one, that's for sure. Well, Jeff, it's great stuff. I got to read some more of it. I got to read that business about John Romita's wife. That I'm completely fascinated by that. I got to know more about that. So just they're great books, great stuff. If you want to know more about that, because you're like me, I want to know things and how things happen the way they do, be sure to get to Your Worshipfulness and Father and Son Issues on Kickstarter. And do it soon so that Jeff doesn't have to refresh the screen all the time to see if anybody's pledged on the Kickstarter, which is that all Kickstarter runners have are destined to do the whole time it's up there. So
you know, great stuff, Jeff. Well.
Yeah, everybody does that. I haven't met a Kickstarter person yet who hasn't sat there, refresh, and gets discouraged if something doesn't change during that time. So it's great stuff. I really have to say, I'm going to have to make sure I'm getting back this too. So it's wonderful things, and I highly recommend you do that too. I think you're going to enjoy both of them. A lot of people like Spider-Man also like Star Wars, so I think you've got a winner on here. So keep it up, Jeff. Do good stuff.
Thank you, Wayne, and it's great talking to you from stately Wayne Manor. I'm assuming that's where you're from.
I always liked that all the Batman stuff had adjectives at the beginning. It was millionaire Bruce Wayne, stately Wayne Manor. I always got a kick out of those kinds of things in Batman 66. You know your comics. I'll give you that.
I think you know your comics pretty well, too, there, Wayne.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.